This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
I'd firstly like to welcome everybody to this next session, which is all about travelling with your dog guide. I'd like to also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the traditional owners of this land and their elders past and present. When I received an email from Martine Abel Williamson, A, I thought, my gosh, I haven't spoken to you for many years, and B, I thought, our first international speaker. And then the topic on which she was hoping to talk about, I'm hoping to go on a cruise with my dog next year. So it's like she was calling to me. Martine is very well known in WBU circles. She's currently the chair of the finance committee, and that will make you laugh afterwards because there's something she said last night that we're going to bail her up for. She, along with Francois Jacobs, who helped her with the research into this survey, ran a survey with support from the WBU about travelling with your dog guides. So without further ado, and it's a very short introduction, but I'm trying to save time here because I think this is going to be a really robust conversation, I'm going to pass you over to both Martine and Francois, and they will pass presentation to each other. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody. It's great to be here and to join you all. The World Blind Union, just a brief reminder, is a worldwide network of organisations of and for the blind. So we do advocacy and capacity building for the just about 285 million blind people across the world. And Australia has always been very involved too. I believe you have Jackie here that's newly appointed as one of your WBU delegates. So there's lots of ongoing work. So when we started the work to do with any area of access to the environment and transport, we knew that we couldn't solve the problems of the world. So we highlighted some priority areas, and the one was shared spaces, where cars and people can move at the same time. The other one was quiet vehicles. And another area was to update the WBU's universal design policy, which we've done. And the fourth area was to do with access to travel, and especially international travel. And although there's many issues such as the screens that are touch screens, so you can't find a call button, and the assistance we receive, we thought to do a specific survey into travelling with a guide dog. And I just say guide dog because both Francois and I got our first dogs from South Africa. They were guide dogs. Then I got my second and third dog from New Zealand. So we just cover all the dog guides or guide dogs when we say guide dogs. So we thought that many people have got anecdotal stories about what happened to them when they travelled overseas with their dogs, but haven't actually been researched. It would be good to say that there has been something done. So I'll pass you over to Francois now. He will cover the survey and the results, and then I will just at the end do a little bit of update on Australia signing the Incheon strategy and other WBU opportunities.
Hi, thanks, Martine. I didn't really think everybody wanted to hear my story of what happened and all that, but I think it's important, especially for those of you who haven't travelled internationally with a dog guide, to understand a typical process of what happens. So it will involve often what happened to me. I moved from South Africa in April last year to Melbourne. Hey. Oh. And I took Nordic with me from South Africa, so that's why I had first-hand experience, and when the opportunity came up to assist Martin with a survey. I thought, well, I had lived experience and I need something to do as well, so it just was a good fit for me. So it started out just over a year before I actually made the move, where the first blood test needed to be done, which is like a RNATT or Tetra test, whatever, because South Africa is a country where rabies is still occurs, although it's like obviously more in the wild. So that was the first thing. And then following months, there were more tests that had to be done, blood taken by the vet sent to a nationally accredited laboratory. Then I had to start looking into application form for a permit from the import country, which would be Australia in my case. That was a 20-page form with lots of personal information, also lots of information that your vet needs to complete. There's a form that you need to take to your GP or a ophthalmologist to certify that you're blind and that you need the assistance. You can't take the one that you did for CenturyLink last month. It must be on their form, on the prescribed form that that you get from the importing country. So even if you from here go to New Zealand, you will have to complete, your doctor will have to use the New Zealand form to complete that section on blindness, so you're going to pay for it. Also, a form which your issuing school, whether it be CEDA or Guidox Victoria, whoever, they need to certify that this is a trained assistance dog. I'm sure they'd prefer to be out training, but this is one of the things that their clients will ask them to do, because just because I want to travel. and then there's lots of other tests leading up to the actual date of travel that you will have to do at specified times, whether it's within 3 months or within 2 weeks of travel. You take all that to your state vet, which will then have to certify that they've seen it and that it's okay. You send it then to the import country, which for me was Australia. They check it and they issue a final list of requirements, which again, your vet might have to comply with additional tests if necessary. And again, your state, the very day before your travel, your state vet needs to issue a permit to say, that's a clearance certificate to say this dog, we officially clear this dog suitable for travel. So, and then once you, I didn't even realize it's such a long process. When you get at the end, landing in Perth for me, Department of Agriculture and Forestry vet needed to come out and check the dog, check paperwork, and then he goes into house arrest for 10 days. Fortunately, being a dog guide, they don't go into a traditional quarantine, but for the next 10 days, they're not allowed interaction with any other domestic animal. After 10 days, you must go to a normal vet. We have to then clear him, your dog, and which again, that clearance you have to send to the Australian authorities to then finally close the case, and then your dog is a citizen. So, yeah, even though I'm not one, but my dog is one. So, yeah, that in brief. So, like Martin said, the aim was, we've all heard about problems that people are experiencing, costs, all these processes you have to go through. Then the survey was conducted by the WBU, and it was sent to service organizations, hopefully such as BCA. I wasn't a member yet, so I don't know if you got the survey. But many blindness-related email groups were sent the survey last year. International Guide Dogs Federation also assisted in it. And the aim was to get an overview of the international experience and hopefully come up with a standardized approach which could be implemented across the board to make it uniform and easier. So some of the things we asked was, if you've been traveling with your dog guide, what worked well for you? And obviously on the flip side of that, what were the problems? And if you have not, if you decided not to take your dog with you, why not? Then are you aware of policies and procedures in place internationally in the area of accessible travel, and what were they? And they asked whether people had access to financial assistance towards this travel cost. And they also asked about collaborative systems across the VET, the state VET, so importing government. Is there any structures for collaboration across all these stakeholders? And the last thing was when they asked for suggestions on how people think, based on the experience, we could improve the process. So they got 30 respondents from representing 8 countries, which was Switzerland, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia. No, I hope I'm saying it right. Japan, Singapore, United States, and Spain. So in terms of what things that worked well, the New Zealanders thought it was easy to complete the forms, but the rest of us disagreed. I remember this a Word document with the personal section, which I wanted to complete myself. It was a column with surname, name, date, but it wasn't in tab format. So it was just they used the tab key to create the columns. By the time I'd completed surname and name, the date was in the next column. So I'd bribe a colleague with some coffee to spend 15 minutes fixing it and putting the lipstick and eyeshadow back on to look, you know, form is correct. There was a lot of people commented on the good assistance we've received from airport staff, which Karen referred to this morning. Generally, the airline staff are good. Officials doing their best to explain all the procedures and the timelines. It's for us, it's really just a case of it is so complicated and outside our comfort zone that if you're anything like me, by the time I walk out the door, half information is gone. So it just seems very complicated when you first get exposed to it. Much more relief areas in dog relief areas around the airports than there used to be. And the freedom of movement that we now, if you have your dog with you, less reliance on sighted guides, because the dog learns quickly, you can navigate open spaces. And people really found that liberating in terms of independent travel. In terms of problems experience, majority of respondents, no surprises there, was the difficulties with the tests and the paperwork. It's inconsistent information depending on who you ask. Even my vet got it wrong. The very last time I went to the state vet, and we got the response from Australian Department of Agriculture and Forestry, there was some test did not cover heartworm, and we had to rush back to the vet on the day before I flew out, and it was the last stress, additional stress you need, because really you're not in charge. You can't read what they wrote on the papers. It's not printed like you can just scan it. So you really, it's not up to you, although you are central to the process. Everything gets driven by the person, the handler. You need to know when to go where. Difficulty access information in the test and the paperwork, which I just explained. You often have to phone call centers, you sit in queues. And Qantas is not the only one. So there's practicalities of fulfilling requirements. You need sighted assistance to complete the forms, and if they get it wrong, you will only find out when it's probably too late, when you're sitting in front of the official to issue the permit, and then the date of birth is not written correctly. So again, the empowerment issue that we don't have. Getting information of guide dog status from the issuing school. Again, that is not a priority for the trainers, and it's not their job to reissue something on a standard just because you need it. That's again where the issue of a standardized international accreditation would come in handy. Obtaining certification of blindness from your GP or a ophthalmologist. It's one of those bureaucracy hoops that you have to jump through. multiple vet visits. I explained to you it's at least, you'll do at least 6 trips around between your vet, the state vet, and back to your vet and so on. And then all the correspondence that you have to go through with the importing country. And you get the issue of dogs being refused at the hotels and restaurants in the country where you visit, because the non-discrimination laws are not in place in all countries. So it's not a guarantee that you will be welcome everywhere. Also, like I explained the process to you, this process has to be started months in advance and could be even as long as a year. So if your grandmother in New Zealand died, you cannot take your dog tomorrow if you have to fly out. It's just the nature of the process doesn't allow that. And when transiting through certain airports, we find even if you're only going to be in the lounge for a while, some countries will still expect you to comply with their processes, even if it's really just a transit. And we've got holdups at airports. If the vet isn't available necessarily when you arrive, some people have missed flights because of it, additional hotel and travel costs. I remember in Perth when I arrived, even though your flight itinerary is one of the first things that you give to DAF, when I arrived in Perth, somehow Canberra didn't tell Perth, so we had to wait for 2 hours for the vet to come out. And my dog, they did not allow me to go with the dog in the quarantine area to relieve himself because we weren't cleared or something. And he didn't like strangers, so it was a bit stressful. Some airports only allow wheelchair assistance. That's not necessarily dog guide related, it's more general, but even if you're a Paralympic athlete, you will sit on the chair. Some airlines also, probably most of them, insist you wait until all the other passengers have disembarked, and if the dog needs to relieve itself, tough, it'll wait until everybody else is gone. Then some airlines also insist on the dog using a muzzle. If it's the first time they have to wear it, it's stressful for the dog. And some, they require the dog to be tethered to a seat. I saw it in New Zealand. That's probably not so strange, but if that's the first time you hear about it, it's like, what? Oh, okay, all right. Just get on with it. In some countries, like I said, the handlers, or you don't enjoy the legal protection, like we have the DDA in Australia, but South Africa, they recommend that proprietors allow them everywhere, but good luck if you want to launch a human rights discrimination complaint, because that's the only option available to you, and that's lengthy, costly, really not feasible. prohibitive cost of attaining all these permits, like I explained to you, it's probably going to cost you $2,000 if you bring a dog from outside of Australia into Australia. That was the case last year anyway. Lack of toileting facilities, there's some at some airports, but still not all of them. We have still airline staff refusing dogs on board airplanes, despite all the paperwork being in place. Again, education, awareness, it's not everywhere. Then the other one was reason why people chose to not take their dog with them was the stress, the frustration, the time, the money, the cost of the test, the inaccessible paperwork, which really is off-putting to many, the emergency travel, which is not possible in some countries. There's some countries where there's no quarantine restrictions, which in which case it's fine. It's just like you're flying from here to Melbourne. But as soon as there's a difference and tests involved, you might not be able to take your dog on emergency travel. Lack of toileting facilities, which I mentioned. unfamiliar destinations, if it's only a few days that you're going away and your dog doesn't know the area, there's really no point if it's just going to be more stress for the pair. So that's what they said. In terms of policies and legislation in place, there's some countries that have it. But even in those countries, people have been saying they're not necessarily confident that at the time of travel, I will be able to access the most relevant, the latest update of this policy, because it can change at any time. And there's this confusion that arises when an airline operates in multiple countries. If you fly with Emirates from Sydney to Auckland, you might find that Emirates doesn't want to carry the dog because of their local legislation or their policies on dogs. And I know of somebody who's been refused Emirates, and just because of the sheer trauma and cost and everything of a human rights complaint, they decided not to. Some examples of this legislation are in the United States, they have the Air Access Act of 1986. This mandates a barrier-free, non-discriminatory access for disabled passengers to take a flight from any point within the states and to be accompanied with your dog guide. Australia, we have our Disability Discrimination Act, and New Zealand also has an act with a long name, Martin, which I can't remember. Then in terms of financial support, people have been saying nobody's aware of any subsidies in place anywhere, but we know that airlines generally do not charge extra to carry the dog. And they even block off the seat next to you. Again, on my immigration flight or when I moved, I was lucky enough to get 4 seats, a sleeping pill, gin and tonic, and I was out. and the dog was obviously nicely stretched out on the floor in front of me, so he had a very good, at least the flight bit of our trip was very good. I'm just jumping to suggestions of what people came up with going forward. They're looking for a more streamlined approach in terms of paperwork and vet visits to standardize it internationally so that authorities and people can become more familiar with the process. We're looking at a central repository which information can be stored, standardized forms and a list of tests and all the requirements that you might need. So there's one point of entry where all these information sits. If you want to know which countries have anti-discrimination laws in place, that it's at one point. Also, it could have a logging facility where the forms, the test results, the next steps are all logged into one place that all the stakeholders, everybody, be it the vet, the government department, guide dog school, everybody can see exactly where we are in the process and what's still outstanding. So that'll eliminate this to and fro communication and the inevitable misunderstanding. Information about countries where anti-discrimination legislation is not in place should be available. And that will allow you as a traveler to make an informed decision on whether you're going to take the chance to take your dog, knowing that you might be refused at some restaurants or hotels. They want relieving stations at all major airports and hubs. And it needs to be inside of security so that if there's flight delays, that does not affect the dog. I mean, you can sit there for 6 hours and you can go to the bathroom, but the dog can't if the relief area is not within security. International certification to attest to the fact that it's a qualified assistance dog. Only problem with that is that self-trained dogs will probably, it will be hard to prove a point there. But we're thinking chipping with the international database could go a long way, maybe ID cards as well. And then just general education, and we're raising awareness of all parties involved. And it's based around the basic human right of freedom of travel. And it has to be a customer-centric approach, because currently what it feels like it's based around the requirements of governments, and it really doesn't take into account you as a customer, the dog as a customer, how do they experience the whole process, especially for them on the plane, for you, or before and after. And address the airline concerns. Maybe promote the use of assistance match to more airlines. It's not used on all airlines. If they have issues with dog hairs in the cabins. And revisit the policy of disembarking all passengers before it's a dog's turn, like I explained earlier on. And especially for Nadia, on cruise ships, there was... they could provide on information on the import regulations of the islands that they're visiting. I mean, they are in the business of travel, and they passing through the ports anyway, so that's just an additional part of what includes travel to these islands. And those who don't allow people to leave their dogs unattended in the cabin, they could provide a paid pet sitting service where you just pay somebody to look after your dog while you go out to the meal where maybe the dog can't go. So on that point, in terms of what of these things will be implemented and how, I'll leave it in the safe hands of my team.
Just before I talk about the WBU's meeting in November, just also what might strengthen and which you may want to use in Australia to push these matters forward is, in 2012, the Incheon strategy was adopted in the Asia and Pacific region, and Australia signed up to it. That started the third decade of disabled people. So that was literally starting 2013 and will conclude at the end of 2022. So what that means is a lot of the items, if you think of the CRPD, but in a bit of a more just different wording, the Incheon strategy is about this. So it's just really hyping up the needs of disabled people. And every year, CSOs, which is civil society organisations, meet to talk about the progress of countries to do with the Incheon strategy. And this year in March, we had a meeting in Bangkok, and it was decided that issues to do with international travel is a big deal, especially for people in motorized wheelchairs, depending on which batteries are being used, if you have to carry specific drugs or medication kits. So we made sure that there's a recommendation in there that the World Blind Union, with the support of the ASEAN Disability Forum and the Deaf Blind Federation, the Worldwide Deaf Blind Federation, work on a paper to be presented at next year's Incheon Strategy Progress Meeting, that we invite the international Aviation Authority to update their wording. So we will hopefully present that, but we need your input. We need your suggestions of what should be in such a paper, what is practicable, so that we can try and progress this internationally. And lastly, in November, the World Blind Union Global Committee will be meeting. And as treasurer, and I'm a bit scared to say as treasurer because I'm going to be reminded of something. As treasurer, we'll be talking not just about the financial sustainability, but what should our priorities be over the next 4 years. So we need to hear from Australia, and I believe you've had your Australian Blindness Forum where you know who your WBU delegates are. So we need to know from you in all the areas, whether it's technology, human rights, access to information, but of course in this specific instance focusing also on access to the environment and transport, what would you like to be remain as priorities or maybe new priorities? And of course we want people's names to be on working groups. We can't do it as a six-person committee stationed all over the world, so we want to create a number of working groups divvy up the areas and then within 4 years work on some priorities. So please contact your local delegates or, you know, I don't mind being contacted myself or whatever. Please let us know by who's got your country support so that we can know who can serve on committees. So without further ado, and before I bump anything else, thank you very much for allowing this presentation, and it was so great to meet all of you, and we're still here for the rest of the day. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you so much, Martine and Francois. A wealth of information there for everyone to gnaw on and get involved with. So we've got a little bit of time, and we have a person to do miking.
Yes.
Good. Just checking. And we have dogs under chairs. So Erica will look out for people,
yeah,
and we're happy to take some questions. Hopefully Francois and Martine are happy to answer the questions.
Yes, Martine and Francois, earlier this year I was talking to a friend from Singapore who travels from Singapore to Perth very regularly. I think he spends about 6 months in each place. And he always brings his dog, and I mentioned to him about the quarantine restrictions. He said, well, it's a lot easier now that they've been changed. So I then sent an email to my friends in the United States who never travel anywhere without their dog Atticus, and said, you know, perhaps this will help you come to Australia. And I can't remember if I sent the internet site about the quarantine or not now, but I got a message right back saying, hey, we've just read it and it looks like we might be able to come to Australia after all. But has the quarantine laws changed? I'm not sure now.
Maybe I can briefly say yes, definitely over the last few years. Veterinary practices and inoculations, the effectiveness of them have definitely improved. Quarantine has improved like along with it, maybe not. We still think that quarantine regulations have not quite kept up to date with the advances, but even I know if I had moved a year before from South Africa, it would have been much more difficult in terms of quarantine. It's just recently where their quarantine status have been upgraded, so it really depends on the two countries of travel of their quarantine status in relation to each other.
Hi, it's Penny. I'm very excited that we're having this discussion. I first took my dog overseas in 2002 and people just thought I was bonkers. And it was, you know, it was challenging, but it was doable. The things that I'm really concerned about is I'm concerned that we haven't got a voice as assistance dog handlers in combating, in being present in these discussions. Like, for example, to go to New Zealand, they're saying that there's Babesia gibsoni is endemic in Australia, and yet my understanding is that actually Babesia gibsoni has not been seen in 10, 15 years, something like that. They were going to review it after 5 and that didn't happen, and yet, you know, and for us as assistance dog handlers, it's not that we're just taking our pet dogs, we're taking working dogs. And they have the spots on the website to say assistance dogs, you know, yes, we've got a special section for you. Actually, it's exactly the same regulations. It's the same paperwork. Yes, the paperwork fees are reduced or, you know, not there, and the quarantine is in home. But other than that, everything else is exactly the same, and it's very frustrating. The other issue that I have is about the health of the dogs, because for going to New Zealand, for example, you have to apply a lot of flea treatment in a very short amount of time. You know, and for example, vaccinations, if you're going overseas, you've got to have your dog, you've got to put in the rabies vaccination, you've got to put in the normal vaccination, you've got to put in all of this, you know, fipronil and whatever, on a regular basis. Whereas, you know, a lot of countries are now actually changing the vaccination schedules for dogs to not put so much drugs in their system all the time. And I'm really concerned that the veterinary standards for international travel aren't keeping up with the welfare standards, I suppose, for dogs in the general community.
Yeah, it absolutely is a balancing act, and whatever we can do to streamline the process, but also making sure that we're looking out for the welfare of the dogs as well. I'm someone who travels internationally who hasn't taken my dog so far, primarily because of the complexities, but also I suppose I think it's quite a bit of a burden for her for a holiday. I think it's completely different if you're moving or significant amount of time between countries. But that being said, you know, I know of people who've taken their dogs and older guide dogs from an Australian summer to a northern hemisphere winter. And, you know, I personally question that, but each to their own. But whatever we can do to streamline the process would be good. And again, we, as far as through AFTO and through ABF, work with the Aviation Access Committee, and I was working with Quarantine more recently, helping a GDWA client emigrate from the UK, and the process seemed to be quite sort of simplified, as far as there was lots of steps to go through, but everyone seemed to be aware of what needed to happen, which is really promising. And also, just as an aside, I was one of the two people elected as an ABF representative to WBU, so I'll leave my contact details with Erica.
As AFDO is Australian Federation of Disability Organisations, WBU is World Blind Union, and ABF is Australian Blindness Forum.
Thank you.
Who on this table had a question? Was it Penny?
At the last conference, I don't know if that person's here, but somebody did give in the tips section, a lot of advice about how she approached travelling internationally, most of which I've forgotten. But the things I do remember is that she said, you need to check where all the accredited vets are, because the one in Los Angeles was apparently 200 kilometres out of Los Angeles. That was one thing. The other thing, choose your airline. Yep. And choose your stopover country. Yeah, and all the rest I can't remember. But it was expensive. And one of the things I haven't heard addressed this time is the actual flight. How do you manage the actual flight?
Yeah.
A gin and tonic and a good lie down, wasn't it?
Yeah, one of the things is, like, if your dog, you give him a little bit of food just before we go. I mean, I was travelling, I think, in the morning. So the previous night I had his good dinner, and then the next morning you'll just have a little bit just to make sure that his sort of blood sugar won't fall long periods. Give him some water. Generally, keep him still. Not let him be too active, because the more active they are, the more water and food they'll need. So just keep him quiet, calm. That's the best you can do, really.
And most people have said to us that their dogs stop drinking. I think the owners make up for it, but the dogs being in an unfamiliar environment stop drinking, and they sort of lie and rest. And I think it's almost a natural reaction. I think some of us have found that in long car vehicle travels, if you stop along the way, unless it's really hot, my dog often just wouldn't do anything. It's as if he's conserving energy, not sure what's going to happen. So I think it's to have something available, but to give them as little as possible without making it stressful.
It's Shala. Nina and I have travelled to New Zealand with work. I did a bargain with work that they paid for her to go, and I paid for myself, because she was $2,300 and I was $700.
Wow.
So that was a pretty good deal. But basically she slept through the whole flight. It was just reducing water and food before getting on that flight. I used massage with her normally, so she had a good old massage session in the middle of it and just passed out. The couple of things, one tip and just something to be aware of from my perspective, was we landed in Auckland at about 10 o'clock at night, and it took another couple of hours to get out of quarantine. So you're looking at midnight, and she's not eaten for quite some time. Now, the food issue was something I had to resolve. I couldn't take, she's on hyperallergenic food, so I can't just go to a local supermarket on the way to the hotel and get that food. So thankfully I was able to get hold of a guide dog organisation in Auckland, and they delivered a bag of Royal Canin hyperallergenic food to my hotel, and I paid for that food. So that was pre-organisation sort of stuff. So those, that sort of organisation, Bibs and Bobs, goes a long way to making it a lot easier. And I rang the hotel that we were checked in to see where the grass was and how many crossings. So all of that was sorted. Finding local vets in case of emergency, but also finding an accredited vet. Something to be aware of. I went through every single letter of the paperwork, and I went between quarantine services in Australia and New Zealand and all around the world. When we got through the process, finally in New Zealand, of getting her through the airport, I said, oh, can I have the paperwork now so that I can get her back out? And they said, oh, no, we don't have that paperwork. So I did not have the accreditation to have her brought back out of New Zealand into Australia, despite the fact that I had filled out every single form, had gone through absolutely everything. So my first half day in New Zealand was spent on the phone with the ministry of whatever it is over there to find out what I needed to do to get her back out of New Zealand. So if I hadn't have asked for that paperwork back, I would have rocked up to the airport thinking that I was clear to get back into Australia and would have been denied. And as it was, the ministry said, look, you're not going to be able to leave here for now for 6 weeks. And I said, but I'm due out of here in 3. And they went, no. And so we argued and argued. And it was a matter of then going through accredited vets and seeing a vet the day before flight and things like that. So do make sure that when you travel, you have the paperwork to bring your dog back home, because I didn't. Okay, so just be very aware of that.
one area that a big hint from me is, because I travel a lot overseas, is that all the processes you go through, which you already know is very complex, well, there's two things actually, but the first one is that your approval only lasts for 3 months. So, well, that was what it was when I last went. So if you, outside of 3 months, you have to do the whole process and cost again. Maybe, was it Karen who was talking about the person from Singapore? Maybe because he travels so much, he makes sure he's within inside that time period, so he doesn't have to do it all over again. And the only other tip I would give is that don't assume that the receiving country will know you're coming. Even though you've filled out the forms with your flight details, as Francois said, and right up to the, you know, when you get the clearance from the Australian vets the day you leave, they often don't let the receiving country know. And so then if you arrive, you wait for a very long time while they scream at you for not telling them, and then go and find a vet. So they're two really important things. Thanks.
Just one additional comment to that is, if you travel to Australia from New Zealand, if I brought Weston with me, a short stay is for 6 days or less, and you need specific requirements, longer stay up to 3 months. So even something such as how long you want to stay might determine some of the processes you need to go through. So, and it's hard because you can't answer a question if you don't know that that question is being asked. So know also that when you do travel, that the time that you will stay in a country might make a difference on the preparation work you'll need to do.
Judging from what so many people have said now, very informed opinions, I really think this says it all for the need for this issue to be addressed in the WBU going forward.
I've just got just a couple of filling information. One, firstly, for Penny, that information you're looking for, Penny, that still is up on the DGA website, and will be accompanied by this session and all the sessions here today. The second one is the person in Singapore, and I'm sure he won't mind if I mention his name, because he's quite happy to speak about his experience, and that is Chang Hock, of course, that Martine and Francois probably already know. He's got a residence in Perth and a residence in Singapore, and he is able to travel freely between Singapore and Perth without going for a quarantine, but If, when he's in Singapore, he travels to China or a place that does have rabies, he then is to go back through the whole process again. But given that Singapore's rabies-free and Australia's rabies-free, he can move between those two countries. But if he moves outside of that, he's got to go through the process again.
Can I just say another website that you may wish to, and I can email the details are actually in the latest East Wind Bulletin, which is the World Blind Union Asia Pacific Bulletin that came out 2 weeks ago, is MIUSA, Mobility International USA. They support disabled people for going for international exchange programs. And there are some good hints and tips about travel and preparation. So I will make sure that this organization get that details, because at the moment I think we just all throw some resources together and websites, and that's the sort of things we'd like to actually try to build into a central resource. So we'll get the MIUSA information, so when you travel, that is some work that they've already done as well.
It's just Penny again. Just about people arriving in airports at different times of night, that's one of the things that I learned is actually often there'll actually be specifications about when you can actually turn up, so that vets will only be available, say, between 10 a.m. and maybe 8 p.m. or 10 p.m. or something like that. So you do actually have to do a bit of careful checking about whether the actual airports have any specifications about what days and times you can actually arrive. And the other thing that I'd really like to see developed is some kind of ongoing passport or something like that, that you can show that you have, established your, that you've had the rabies vaccination, that you've got the titer tested, like last year or whatever, that you are regularly, keeping up your vaccination schedule, that you're keeping up your flea treatment schedule and things like that. Even if you have to get it signed off at your vet, on a weekly, monthly basis, it's a lot easier than having to jump through those hoops. If we could think about some kind of idea like that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Martin and Francois are around for the rest of the day, so go hunt them out and harass them. No, and ask them any questions. I'm sure they'd be happy to answer about the survey. I think it's a fascinating piece of work. I look forward to, as new president, my gosh, of DGHA, we look forward to having, contributing to this kind of work, because it's something that we have discussed as a committee, the issues of travelling and international travel with your dog guide. In appreciation of your presentations, we have a small gift for both of you, but wait, there's more. Remember when I said that Martin is the treasurer? She last night when I was taking the treat jar around, there was one of the treats was in a sealed bag on the side of the treat, and she was looking at it. She was giving it careful consideration to make her guess, and she said. And these aren't the exact words, but you'll get the gist. She said, oh, wow, I've just broken it, so now I've made two into one. Welcome to your treasurer. So in recognition of that, we would also like to present her with a Black Cabs $25 cab voucher to get her out of this country. back on the plane. And we really, really want to pass on our sincere gratitude for you coming across the ditch to present here at our conference. Thank you so much, and thank you, Francois.
Thanks.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?